Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, books on magic. With us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Caitlin Doggart from Where the Sidewalk Ends in Chatham. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Mindy. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Caitlin.
So today, it's books on magic, even though it's books are magic, but our theme today is magic. And I'm so excited to see what you both have brought. And normally, if we weren't in a pandemic, we would be in the studio together. And I love that we usually spread the books out on the table in front of us, and I can kind of look over the piles before we go on the air. So I have no clue. I'm imagining somebody brought Harry Potter. But other than that, and I know that what would not be you, Jill. You're not a big Harry Potter fan. But what? Kick us off, Jill. What do we got to start? What are we starting with?
I just want to say a little bit about how this about this topic and magic and the magic. When I think of magic, there are lots of different ways to think about magic. And in prepping for this show, I found more and more ways to think about magic. But needless to say, as a librarian and who, as someone who started reading at a very young age, I still think the magic of reading is one of the most important and amazing and wonderful kinds of magic. And
right.
And it's just when I first began to read as a kid, and the first book I remember reading to myself was Cat in the Hat, which involves magic. It's just such a revelation, right? You go from people reading to you, to because I was lucky enough to have people around me who read to me all the time, and then you suddenly gain this new magical ability, and that's reading. And
so true.
It's so exciting. And I think magic historically has got, you know, there's black magic, there's white magic, there's all kinds of different kinds of magic. But that, boy, the magic of reading is great. And what I realized also from thinking about when I first started reading books about magic, and you've got it right, Mary Poppins, right? I love the magic in Mary Poppins. Cat in the Hat, that's got magic. Charlotte's Web is full of magic. And, of course, fairy tales. Fairy tales are chock full of magic. And as Mindy mentioned, and I'm not a fan of Harry Potter. And I think part of that is, again, it gets back to when you read something, it can have a huge impact to you, or you miss the boat. And I'm sort of sorry I missed the boat on Harry Potter, because people love those books. And right. What was interesting in choosing books for this show was how many, like practically every fiction book having to do with magic after Harry Potter is like everybody thinks they're trying to make money off of Harry Potter. Harry Potter was this great series of books that had a lot of magic in them. And so it's interesting to see how that, you know, and I thank Harry Potter for creating all these other magical books. It's great.
Well, not only that, but also just how many children, you know, just really got interested in that whole series and, you know, became readers because of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. A lot of kids who probably had not been reading books the size of Harry Potter, although I'm sort of astonished, actually, to see how young kids are who read. There are a lot of very young children who read the Harry Potter books, and every book is good for a certain age, but I wonder how much, you know, if you don't read a book sort of at the right age, and in my case, I sort of missed Harry Potter. I think I was just not at the right age for reading those books, that you lose something. You know, you don't get the full impact of the book. I mean, somebody...
You know, it's a good point that you're bringing up. Caitlin, since you're running a bookstore, I'm sure you get people coming in and asking that question. I have a five-year-old grandson who I can't wait for him to be old enough to read Harry Potter or read to him, but he's way too young to understand what's happening there. What do you tell people when they come in looking for the Harry Potter series about what age is appropriate?
I think it's really up to the discretion of the parents. If they're reading along with them, it can start younger. But I do think the later ones in particular get dark. And I love Catherine Patterson, the author, described once. She wrote The Bridge of Terabithia, and she said, you know, for a lot of people say, well, you know, my child read the book, maybe they could see the movie. And she said that no, because a child's imagination has natural barriers. And so they will never go beyond what they're capable of imagining. And so I think reading Harry Potter with a child would be very different than seeing a movie, because then they don't control the images that their imagination are conjuring up.
What a great point. I would not have thought of that. That is a very good point.
Yeah, I think she's brilliant.
Yeah, that is brilliant. All right, Jill, what are we starting with?
Well, and that's so true that you know, part of the again, the sort of one of the things that happened with Harry Potter very pretty quickly was it was turned into films. And you make such a good point, Caitlin, about how when you're reading, you are making all the images. Mm-hmm. And when you go to a film, it's very, very different experience. In any case, and may I just say, I think radio is one of the most magic things in the world as well, and that everybody that works at WCAI are magicians, because somehow we can all be sitting in different places in the universe, and yet we're all talking to one another. And apparently there are people listening. It's an incredible thing, the magic
of
radio.
It is inherently magical, and I was very glad this is radio and not a Zoom call or anything like that, because I had this fear that I'd be asked to do a magic trick. Glad that nobody can see.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say because you're still in your pajamas or something.
Oh, no. But I do have my books spread out. I'm in my car and I've spread out all the books because I do think that they are magical just to touch them.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't have the same experience reading on, you know, a Kindle or something like that. I like to have the book in my hand. You're right about that.
All right, so, and to the books. I have to say, I'm starting with a couple of books about the history of magic, which turns out is a very interesting thing, which includes, you know, magic being alchemy and witchcraft and all sorts of various things, depending on who's defining what magic is. And the first book I have here is called Magic, A History from Alchemy to Witchcraft, From the Ice Age to the Present by Chris Gosden. It is a heavy tome. Neither one of these magic books having to do about the history of magic are light reading, but very interesting reading. And this one I learned about originally from the Wall Street Journal book section, and they did this big review on Magic by Chris Gosden. And here's a little bit about what they said about the book, which I think captures it pretty well. His book is an attempt to trace changes over time and among cultures in the relationship between science, magic, and religion, a triple helix, as he calls it, that spins through the centuries and still envelops commonplace superstitions. And he says there are delightfully entertaining passages, especially on picturesque spells. An ancient Greek example cursed a sexual rival's little buttocks. Another in 19th century England doomed temperance campaigners in maledictions pinned to onions and stuffed up a pub chimney. In ancient Egypt, humans could appropriate divine incantations used by Isis and to allow Osiris to copulate with her, although he was dead. A doctor in England in 1671 recommended reversing witchcraft by putting, quote, urine, hair, and nail clippings into a bottle with nails, thorns, and pins. So there's a lot of interesting magic in this history of magic. And the author says that people do magic, quote, to survive in their world, but to make sense of it. And so this is a very sort of academic look at the history of magic, but interestingly ends with this whole chapter on the environment and the magic of the environment. And it's this sort of call to arms at the end of the book, which seems like a very odd place to end the book, but that it is both a historic look at what magic has been and how magic has presented itself, but ends with the magic that's going to be needed to save the environment. And the other title I brought is also a sort of heavy-duty magic history. It's called Magic in Western Culture, From Antiquity to the Enlightenment by Brian Copenhaver. And as one of the reviews says, in spite of its focus on the history of magic, this book is in fact essential reading for students of the history of ideas, the history of philosophy, the history of medicine, the history of science. There's a lot of crossover between science and magic, and even students of art history, since Copenhaver places great stress on the significance of images in both the development and the dismemberment of the Western magical tradition. It would be a shame if the book's readership were confined to historians of magic, since its significance is so much more far-reaching. And again, this is sort of heavy-going reading. It's not a light, it's serious history about magic. And it is sort of looking at magic through the entire beginning of time to now, and it's called Magic in Western Culture from Antiquity to the Enlightenment by Brian Copenhaver. So there are two heavy-duty history books.
Starting us off with the heavy stuff.
Magic.
All right, Caitlin, what's your first book?
My first book is called The Midnight Library, in honor of our librarian Jill here.
Oh, thank you.
It's by Matt Haig. And I was utterly transfixed by the concept and then couldn't put it down. So it's a novel, and it's recent. I believe it's on various bestseller lists right now as well. But it's a really great book now, because when we're relying so much on our imaginations in quarantine, this one is endlessly fascinating to kind of reflect on your own life and other people's lives. So the plot is that there's a woman named Nora Seed, who's a 30-something woman in Bedford, England, who decides she wants to die. And she finds herself in the Midnight Library, which is a space between life and death. And it's this expansive library full of all the volumes of all of her possible lives based on the outcome of every single decision she had ever made. So what she could do is pick the volume of the life she would have lived if she, for example, hadn't quit her sport of swimming, or if she had followed a particular music dream, or if she'd said yes to coffee with a particular person. And then she begins to read that volume and enters that life. So it's essentially like a magical what if of a life spun out into a book, which is just crazy to imagine.
But it's a great idea, this idea, because it's so true, isn't it? Like you turn left instead of right and something else happens, right?
And you go, what if, right? Yeah.
So Nora Seed had the opportunity to read and then enter the life for each decision. And the trajectories are infinite. But I love that the author, Matt Haig, he's not overbearing with the concept. So he allows room for doubt, and then sort of without giving anything away, sort of guides Nora and the reader to also seeing the beauty of the life that you are living and the decisions that you are making right now. It's just a really fascinating novel.
And then tell us what's the name of it again?
It's called The Midnight Library.
Great. We have an email from Anju in North Falmouth who says, just started reading Harry Potter to my 8-year-old son. Talk about a magical experience. Great, Anju. Thanks for sharing. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book on magic or you have some thoughts or comments for us this morning. 866-999-4626. You can also shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. Today, Books on Magic with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Caitlin Doggart from Where the Sidewalk Ends Bookstore in Chatham. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what's next?
My next book is actually the beginning of a trilogy, and this is, which I've not gotten through the whole trilogy. I'm still in book one, but I'm really loving book one. It is called The Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. It is book one of the All Souls trilogy, and I have no doubt one of the reasons I'm already loving this book is because it starts in the Bodleian Library at Oxford, a library I've actually had the pleasure of being in, and it's a spectacularly wonderful place. So there's that, which makes it very important for me in particular. But there was a very funny review of this in Los Angeles Times when it came out. And in that review, they write, there's something inspiring inspiring for old-fashioned book lovers about an early scene in Deborah Harkness's novel, A Discovery of Witches. Magical creatures gather as a woman opens a legendary lost book. Never mind that most of these creatures, vampires, demons, witches, are plotting to get the book out of the hands of Diana, an American professor on a research trip in England. Menace aside, the scene is almost an homage to the printed word. There's far more magic in an old book than in an iPad, no matter how good its backlighting is. So there is that. It is very much book-based in terms of the plot and library-based. But this particular researcher, as it happens, has parents who were both witches. And she has decided to try to live her life without using her witch powers. However, in spite of her good intentions right at the beginning of the book, she is in this library and this book sort of comes to life for her, which catches the attention of the amazing number of vampires and witches there happen to be in Oxford. I have to say, I was sort of stunned by the number of people who show up. And one of the delights of this book is that it is not only a great story about how she's trying to cope with her witch abilities, or not cope, as the case may be, It is a sort of funny, it's got a lot of humor in it, as well as being a very tense story. So, for example, when she falls in, well, she's beginning to fall in love with a vampire, which is never a good idea to fall in love with a vampire, I would say. But he takes her to this gorgeous house in the countryside, and what are all the witches and vampires? They all get together, and the only thing they all get together for is yoga. So they're all doing yoga together, which I thought was hilarious. And there is also a connection to New England in this book. This is a little bit about her mother. Her mother had a curiosity about the world that led her beyond the safety of Madison. She went first to Harvard, where she met a young wizard named Stephen Proctor. He also had a long magical lineage and a desire to experience life outside the scope of his family's New England history and influence. And she talks about her mother, and she doesn't really know when she's a child what her parents are. She doesn't realize that they're witches, but she does say, other recollections of my parents would not. My mother never seemed to do laundry, but my clothes were always clean and neatly folded. Forgotten permission slips for field trips to the zoo appeared in my desk when the teacher came to collect them. And no matter what condition my father's study was in, when I went in for a goodnight kiss, and it usually looked as if something had exploded, it was always perfectly orderly the next morning. In kindergarten, I'd ask my friend Amanda's mother why she bothered washing the dishes with soap and water when all you needed to do was stack them in the sink, snap your fingers, and whisper a few words. So she's aware that she grew up with witches. Her parents, as I say, die, but she continues to try to fight her magical powers. And when she meets this very handsome vampire, there is, again, quite a bit of humor about. Now, you wouldn't think there was a lot of humor in vampires, but in this case, she writes, anyone who has read paperback bestsellers or even watched television knows that vampires are breathtaking, but nothing prepares you to actually see one. Their bone structures are so well honed that they seem chiseled by an expert sculptor. Then they move or speak, and your mind can't begin to absorb what you're seeing. Every movement is graceful, every word is musical, and their eyes are arresting, which is precisely how they catch their prey. One long look, a few quiet words, a touch. Once you're caught in a vampire snare, you don't stand a chance. So this is her story. And again, it's a trilogy. It starts with this, and she finds this magical book. All the vampires come out. All the witches come out. And she is trying both to deal with her family history of having grown up as a witch and her wish to not essentially do what her parents had done, to try to avoid using her magic, which, of course, is not going to be possible. But it's called A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness, a really great read. And again, it is the beginning of a trilogy.
All right. Let's talk to Rand, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, Rand.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've been listening with interest, and I'm always interested in how magic is seen as the extraordinary or the miraculous. And it made me think of the closing quote from Darwin's Origin of Species, which I wanted to share.
Go ahead.
This is how he closes the Origin of Species. There is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. I thought of this because the other day I was listening to the radio, actually WOMR, someone played a folk song by someone who said, you know, I think the refrain was, you know, we look, where is magic? And we think, you know, where isn't magic? So I'm just thinking about the connection between magic and nature.
Yeah.
And I'm currently reading a book. I'm an organic farmer, and I'm reading a book called Sacred Agriculture, The Alchemy of Biodynamics. And I think that this book is really interesting because it's trying to make a connection between alchemy and modern science and chemistry, and looking at the life in the soil. So as an
I think somebody else may, you know, I'm thinking somebody else may have recommended that book in one of our previous shows. It's sounding very familiar.
So. Yeah, it's Sacred Agriculture, the Alchemy of Biodynamics. It's by Dennis Klosek, K-L-O-C-E-K. It's very dense, and I can't understand most of it, but there's a lot of chemistry, a lot of reference to the elements, and I just wanted to say that if you work with the soil and you work with farming, I feel that you're in touch with both science and magic at the same time, and they come together in a kind of art, I would say.
Yeah. Ren, thanks for calling. Thanks for sharing that. I mean, very good points. We appreciate that. If you'd like to share your thoughts or book, 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Annie from Edgartown says, I just finished reading The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. This was one of the first books your guest suggested. It was wonderful and highly recommend it to your readers. It was one of those books I was sad to see end. That's one bad thing about a good book is when it ends, you're like, no, I want it to keep going. Caitlin, what's next?
Right, and it's never quite the same book the second time you read it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Caitlin, what's next on your list?
The next on my list kind of connects to both of the callers, where Rand said, and I love that, where isn't magic? And the first listener who was talking about reading to her 8-year-old grandchild, I think magic really, it really is magical to read to a child. So anybody who has access to a child would enjoy this book. It's called Magical Creatures and Mythical Beasts. And it's by Professor Byron and Millie Mortimer with these gorgeous illustrations by Victo Ngai, N-G-A-I. And it says 8+. But I think that's only because there's a battery in the magical flashlight that can hit it. So if there's supervision, it can certainly delight children much younger. And I was thinking, I wish I'd done is taken an audio recording of, I have two little boys, and when they first opened this up, the gasps were wonderful. It follows a professor, actually out of Oxford, England, so we'll go back to that library, and he's taking his little girl, Millie, on a research trip around the world. He studies, you know, folklore and myths, and he's finding out about legends across the globe. Millie finds a magical flashlight before they leave, and then each page, it's gorgeous, they're big spreads, for maybe a dozen different places, maybe a little more, actually, maybe 18. And he's a skeptic, and he's like, I hope she's not disappointed when we don't actually see anything. So we see what he sees, you know, the actual geography. And then if you shine the flashlight on the pages, these the mythical monsters and magical beasts appear kind of magically with this flashlight. So it is so much fun for kids to look through. And I love it because it also ties in geography and history, and there's a little fact or fiction section on each page. And then at the end, the last page has a chance for you to go back and find sort of further mythical creatures on each page. So it goes from Uzbekistan to the, you know, the Virgin Islands to the Great Wall of China. It's just a really fantastic book.
What's the name of it again?
It's called Magical Creatures and Mythical Beasts, and it has a magic flashlight.
Great. I love that. Okay. Jill.
Okay. Well, we can't really talk about magic without at least mentioning Houdini, who is one of the most famous magicians around and on the planet, I would say. And there are a trillion books that have come out about Houdini. That's roughly a trillion. I know there might be more than a trillion. But there is a recent one that came out called The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini by Joe Posnansky. And as they talk about this book, they're talking about there are more than 500 books about Erich Weiss, a.k.a. Harry Houdini. And Posnansky still delivers a jaunty and infectious biography of the famous magician and his impact on magic and popular culture. And it talks about his childhood, he was born in Appleton, Wisconsin, but he was actually born in Budapest, which I did not know before I looked at this book. This lie discovered Posnansky is a key to understanding how Houdini achieved his mythic status. Houdini believed that magic was about the performer more than the performance, and the bigger, gaudier, more dangerous, more thrilling, the better. Houdini, in this version of his life, is a consummate liar and a genius at self-promotion. I did not know that he had a ghostwriter, and that ghostwriter, of all people, was H.P. Lovecraft. I'm sure there are a lot of H.P. Lovecraft fans out there. Who know? But Lovecraft was there to tell, as the author says, tell exaggerated tales about him or write short stories under the Houdini name, and planted self-aggrandizing stories about himself in the local newspapers of the towns where he performed. And so it sounds like it's really a great story, right? And he was a good musician, but he was, above all, a remarkable performer. That's what he could do. And I love, and this review, at the end, they say, spoiler alert, the author does not reveal any Houdini secrets. So if you're looking for the secrets of his magic, you won't find it in The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. But I also want to mention a kid's book on Houdini called Escape, The Story of Great Houdini. This is pretty much for ages 9 and up, but one of the things I really loved about it was it is packed full of images of Houdini's tricks and Houdini and the advertising for Houdini. I did not know that he was in a 1919 film called The Master Mystery, where Houdini meets the first robot in motion picture history. This is the sort of thing you find out when you start reading about Houdini in kids' books.
Right.
And for Houdini in 1919, being a movie star was the grimmest game of all. Apparently, he was not good at being in the movies. But again, this is worth it just to see all the images of Houdini from a young man into his years of success. It's called Escape, The Story of the Great Houdini by Sid Fleischman.
All right. And I should mention, if you're trying to jot down all these titles, we will have a link later this afternoon to all the books that we talk about this morning at our website, capeandislands.org. All right, Caitlin.
Okay, my next one's another novel. It's called Conjure Women by Afia Attakara. And it's just a gorgeous novel about two women in sort of on the eve of the Civil War. So there's there's a mother, Maybelle, in her enslaved times, and then they live on a plantation, and then her daughter is after, you know, in the freedom time, and so it goes back and forth between 1854 and 1867. And they're both healers, but they both have the ability to to conjure curses as well. And the Rue is just a wonderful character, and you feel, I think, as a reader, so connected to her because she is there trying to heal her community when a sickness comes through and is taking the lives of a lot of children. And it corresponds also to the arrival of a sort of a traveling preacher who starts to kind of turn the community against her and accuse her healing of being something sinister. And what she's actually trying to do is protect their community. And it was just neat to kind of read the standard sort of the healing woman as a witch that we think of as mostly in Salem and see it in a completely different context in the South. And I saw an interview with the author, again, it's Afia Attakora, Atakora, and she said how, and I thought this was really magical, she just loved books, and she so desperately wanted to be an author that when she was little, she carved her initials into the library shelves of where her book would one day be.
I love that.
And it was adorable, because she said she later ended up, you know, working at the library as a teenager, and she didn't take into account that shelves would be replaced, and that also there's weeding out and new titles would come in, and so it would never be at that particular spot. And the bookshelves were replaced before her book was published. But it's her debut novel. It's fantastic. It came out in the spring, and I feel like authors who had their debut novels in the spring were particularly shortchanged with the pandemic because they couldn't tour. So this one is just, it's not to miss. It's just, it's great historical fiction, and it draws in so much magic and just really wonderful characters.
And again, the title?
The title's called Conjure Women.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 for your suggestion on Books on Magic. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Books on Magic with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Caitlin Doggart, where the Sidewalk Ends bookstore in Chatham. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what's next?
Well, given that a lot of us are spending a lot of time in our houses lately, this book caught my eye. It's called House Magic, and it's HausMagic, House Magic, Transform Your Home with Witchcraft by Erica Feldman. And Erica Feldman, it turns out, has a shop in Salem, Massachusetts, and her shop is trying to help you add more magic to your house and how that can help you. She's a founder of the magical healing company called House Witch, and in this book, she sort of guides people through the simple magical practices that you might be able to use in your home. And she's blending, which seems like a very odd combination, but I can see how it might work, blending interior design with tools for spiritual health, and talking about how the physical environment can influence and help you access the magical realm. In her intro, she writes, "House magic will guide you through the key ways I believe you can harness the positive energy in your home. Over the years, I've worked with a range of experts from interior designers and antique dealers to makers, artists, and of course, witches. Combining their creative knowledge with my own personal study of earth magic, astrology, tarot, and energy work, I've crafted this magical instruction manual for you. Each field of wisdom aims to achieve balanced energy in various areas of life, which will allow you to live in harmony with yourself and nature, and that includes the energy of your home." And it's actually got lots of beautiful photographs in it as well. First chapter called Witching 101, she talks about what the word witch, the acronym she likes for the word witch, which is for a woman in total control of herself, which, as she says, is something she strives very hard to be. And she writes, as a feminist, I believe that the witch is an amazing archetype for channeling the innate and often unseen power of the divine feminine. To me, the word witch represents all that has been oppressed by patriarchy, and using the title today is reclaiming of it. Every witch sees herself differently, but I believe that what unites us is the effort to stay centered and grounded in our energies so that we can use our inner strength to manifest the things that we want to bring into our lives and the world around us. And I would have to say we all probably need a lot of inner strength right now. But she goes from sort of the very magical to the how best to wash your floor. And there's actually a recipe for Cozy from the Ground Up Floor Wash. And it seems like it's a very simple, but, you know, maybe it would work. She says the scent of orange, she has orange in here, the scent of orange can lift the spirits and elevate your mood, whereas juniper calms the nervous system, helping to reduce anxiety, and fir can make you feel more confident. And these are all things that are in this mix, and she has, as I say, the actual recipe for this in her book. So, you know, it's in some ways very practical, and I can see how, in fact, it might inspire somebody to be a little more thoughtful about washing their floor and how you can make that a better experience for yourself. And we could all use a better experience, I'm sure, in cleaning our houses now that we're spending most of our time in them.
Yeah. So
it's called House Magic, Transform Your Home with Witchcraft by Erica Feldman.
Interesting. We got an email from John in Vineyard Haven who says, the late, great Ricky Jay's Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, a fabulous read. John, thanks for that suggestion. If you have a suggestion, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Caitlin?
Okay, my next one is it's called The Murmur of Bees by Sophia Segovia. And it was recommended to me by a friend who's a great reader. And she said, you have to listen to the audio. And I'm not a big audio person, but she said that the voices are so captivating and lilting and the accents are so beautiful. And I followed up on it because we have an account with Libro FM, which supports the indies. And it was absolutely mesmerizing. It, and it ties in. It's not a new book. It's from 2019, but it connects now because it's set in Mexico during the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 and 1919. So definitely resonates with now. And it follows a family. It's a wealthy farming family. And they find a disfigured little abandoned baby who's covered in a blanket of bees. And he becomes sort of the stuff of superstition. But he's welcomed by this family as their godchild, and they raise him as their own. And he can't speak, but he has these visions, and he's able to come convey things to help this family, and that becomes sort of his purpose in life. So there's also the Mexican Revolution going on. There's, you know, the pandemic, and their whole town is just decimated by it. And he finds his way as he grows up to protect the family. And it's just a gorgeous book. His name is Simon Opio, and it's just a really a mesmerizing story. She's a pretty prolific author in Mexico, but this is her first novel that was translated into English. Definitely worth a read or even a listen.
I was going to say the same thing. You're talking about the voices of reading. That makes such a huge difference if you're listening to books on tape. If it's a voice that just isn't resonating with you or you can't understand, it just ruins the experience. So when you can find voices that really pull you in, what a different experience that can be.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah. Jill.
Yeah, well, and as I've said before, anything that Jeremy Irons narrates is, you know, I can listen to it forever, and I can listen to it over and over and over again.
Yeah. Except for, I've said,
of the voice.
I've said before, anything with Jeremy Irons, I go immediately to Lion King and Scar, right? Well, Scar is reading this book.
Okay, so this next book, sometimes I just have to bring a book because I love it so much, and it is called The Magic of Handwriting, and by Christine Nelson, and it was actually the catalog for an exhibit that was done at the Morgan Library Museum. Of this fellow's incredible collection of letters. But the reason it really struck me was because it is called The Magic of Handwriting, and it is something that is becoming a lost art, right? As more and more people are typing and on computer screens, and children apparently are no longer necessarily being taught how to write with your pen or your pencil, And so she has this great intro about magicians, and here's a little bit of it. She says, magicians are conjurers. They summon what is hidden, a coin or a scarf or even a fluttering bird, with a flick of the wrist and a word of incantation. They are also concealers. They guard their secrets, and if their tricks are good and our hearts are open, leave us questioning and marveling. There's no magic without our complicity. So it is with the handwritten page. Its magic derives from its capacity to conjure the human being who once marked the paper. Its mystery lies in all that remains indecipherable or simply unuttered. The magic of handwriting is therefore a book of spells. Here we see, or seem to see, Marcel Proust creating In Search of Lost Time, Isaac Newton doing simple math, Elizabeth I taking charge at the dawn of her reign. Just like magic, their manuscripts evoke their famous hands caught in fleeting moments of composition, calculation, and command. At the same time, we are under no illusion that we can join Proust, Newton, and Elizabeth in true conversation. The pages of this book invite us to engage in leaps of imagination that grant us access to the dead and distant, even as we acknowledge the artifice of that communion, just as we accept with pleasure and wonder the magician's sleight of hand. And it is literally a book of letters, but they have done a great job of photographing many of the letters so that you can see all this different handwriting within the book. And there is a certain magic to still getting a paper letter, and you don't know when it's going to come. And it, of course, when I was a kid, you know, there was nothing more magical than finding the letter in the mailbox for you. So I think it is still this great, great way of communicating, and that more and more people are discovering that a handwritten letter has something special and magical about it that an email does not. And if you want to read a lot of great magical letters, you can look at The Magic of Handwriting, which is a beautiful tribute to one man's collection of letters, but also to the whole idea of writing by hand.
We have a couple of listener suggestions. One, a school-aid recommendation from Cheryl, says Half Magic by Edward Eger. Children find a magic rock that grants half of their wishes. They travel through time to various places like King Arthur's court, have to learn to double wishes. Thanks for that. And then another listener suggesting The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. Older novel based on the Iliad, talks about magic in a wonderful way, a nice cross between myth and reality. Thanks for those suggestions. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Caitlin.
Oh, well, I'm so glad a listener mentioned Madeline Miller. One of my books is Circe, which followed up on Song of Achilles. And it just brings Greek mythology to a very sort of heart-wrenching story. And it's fascinating because it's, you know, I think one of the reviewers said, you know, it's not, we know how everything turns out. We've known it for thousands of years. And yet, in Miller's lush reimagining, the story feels harrowing and unexpected. And it's true. It follows Circe, the daughter of the sun god, and she just makes an appearance in the Odyssey, but Madeline Miller spins it out into a whole novel of Circe, and she, turns the men into pigs when they come to her island. But it draws on all her magic and her life over thousands of years, and the choices that she has to make to not be lonely. And it's just a really gorgeous novel. The cover's beautiful too. The face and the gold. So I'm glad they mentioned Song of Achilles. I love Song of Achilles, and Circe, I think I loved even more.
All right, good to know. Jill.
A next book I'm going to mention is a book called Garden Spells, and this is by an author named Sarah Addison Allen. I feel like I've mentioned this before because it's got a very important tree in it, and I believe a very magical tree. And I feel like when Dennis and I were talking about books about nature and trees, I believe this book came up. But her first book was called The Sugar Queen. And in that book, it's the characters are followed around by books, and if the powers that be thinks the lead character needs a book to help her through a certain situation, that book would appear in her vicinity, maybe on the coffee table in the living room or on the kitchen counter next to where she was cooking dinner. And if she ignored the book, it would somehow follow her to work and put herself in front of her there. So that was sort of The Sugar Queen. But the one I liked even better is Garden Spells. And it is a story of a woman going back to North Carolina where she grew up and finding that she has this incredible, there's a lot of food in this book because she has magical spells that she uses with her food that do various things to various people. And there is a magic tree. And of course, there is also a romance with the man who lives on the other side of the magical tree. And as one of my coworkers said, Garden Spells is a wonderful romp. It's a great book where everyone gets what coming to him or her. She imbues her characters with magical talents, not Harry Potter-esque magic powers per se, but talents. And as she says, have you ever met anyone who seemed to have an almost unbelievable touch with plants or with automobile engines? But both The Sugar Queen and Garden Spells have extremely satisfying endings. Garden Spells by Sarah Addison Allen, or her first book, which was The Sugar Queen by Sarah Addison Allen, both full of a great sort of easy read, light stories, and essentially happy endings. And who could not use a happy ending right now?
Happy endings are good right now. Lydia writes, I'm recommending the series Keeper of the Lost Cities by Shannon Messenger for anyone who loves magic and fantasy. This series is for children, but I personally think that any age would love to be consumed in this amazing book series. The overview of these books are about Sophie Foster, who's brought to an elven world from the human world, and she discovers that she is an elf herself. She and her friends go on many adventures throughout this 9-book series. Shannon Messenger just came out with the latest book, number 8.5 Unlocked, which has exclusive pictures and background information about the world of elves. She's currently writing the 9th, technically the 10th book in this extraordinary series, and I'm so excited to see what happens next. Lydia, thanks for that. And a reminder, if you've missed any of the titles or authors, we will have a list of all the books we talked about this morning. A little bit later on this afternoon, Jill's going to put that together for us. So check in later at capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Caitlin Doggart from Where the Sidewalk Ends Bookstore in Chatham. Thank you both for such great recommendations this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy, and thanks, Caitlin.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.